description of the universal form and how the universal form was like in the comparison between the super soul, Garbhadaksha Vishnu, and the universal form, it is like the soul and the body. The soul was in the heart and the body. Without the presence of the soul, the body does not grow. And without the presence of the super soul, the universe does not manifest. And the universe does manifest based on this universal form. The question that Maitreya Muni is now answering has to do with what Vidura asked about the Lord and His energies and the living entities and their forms and their places of residence, etc., and how the Lord manifests these things through His different energies. So the universal form is being explained to show how the living entities and their particular situations are being manifest, and how ultimately all of them are dependent upon Krishna. Krishna is the cause of all causes. From Krishna, everything else manifests. By Krishna's glance, Maya Dakshena Prakriti Suyate Sacharacharan, at every stage, things progress. And ultimately, the design of how the universe does progress, that too is Krishna. The working of the senses, the adibhautika person, the sense of self, the adiatmika person, and the workings of the senses by the superior forces of the demigods, the adidaivika person, all these three are manifested from the... Someone turn the volume down on the people outside in the hall. You can invite them. All the things are manifesting. The numbers were used in some of the verses yesterday, the 1, the 3, and the 10. Everything is manifested from the one. The souls are manifested from the one supreme consciousness. The three senses of the self, the adibhautika, adiatmika, and adidaivika, they are manifested also from the one Lord, and also the 10 senses, the 10 life airs rather. They are also coming from the soul who is getting the energy ultimately from the super soul. So everything is ultimately springing from Krishna. And then, when the universal form actually begins its manifestation, all the demigods who are in charge of the different bodily parts, they enter into specific aspects of the universal form. And because of their entry into the universal form, then they can perform their function of allowing that particular sense of the living entity to work. So we are completely dependent upon Krishna. We are dependent on the demigods as well, but ultimately the demigods too, even for their workings within the material world, are also dependent upon Krishna. So directly we are dependent on Krishna, indirectly we are dependent on Krishna. And yet, this Supreme Lord is very difficult to understand. Very difficult to understand, because we directly only see the manifestations from Him and we don't directly see Him. So one of these manifestations is this universal form, the Vratarupa or Vishwarupa, which is very, very difficult to understand because it is everything, everywhere, throughout the entirety of the universe. So we read up to yesterday in the description of the universal form, up to text 16. So as the explanation continues, one by one, the demigods, the universal form manifests a particular aspect of his body. The demigod enters, for instance, he manifests the skin. Then the demigod controlling the skin will enter that aspect of the universal form, and then the living entities will gain by the demigod's entry, they will gain the ability for the use of the skin in its sensibility. So one by one, the universal form manifests in this way, and is preparing something. It is preparing the manifestation for the manifestation of the universe, and at this point especially, it is preparing for the working of the living entity within the universe. So everything, one by one, is manifest, from the genitals to the evacuating channel, the hands of the universal form, up to verse 25, one by one, the different parts of the body of the universal form are manifest, the legs, which give the ability for movement, and then in 23, the more subtle aspects with the particular demigods. In 23, the intelligence of the universal form manifests. And then Brahma, the primal demigod, enters into that, and therefore the living entities gain the ability to understand. And then in 24, the mental activities come by the grace of Chandradev, the moon god, when the mental activities of the universal form manifest. And then our old friend, the false ego, manifests in the universal form. And what is the false ego? It is a separate sense of self. Now we have our separate senses of self, but because we're individuals. But when that separateness includes being separated from Krishna, then our ego or identity is considered false. So then, by the entry of Rudradev, or Lord Shiva, an aspect of Lord Shiva, then the living entity gains his ability of that false ego with his own particular individual separate activities, etc. Then in 26, the consciousness of the universal form manifests. The Mahatattva enters, and then the living entity gets his own consciousness. Then through 27 through 29, the three planetary systems manifest. Now the shift of the universal form, the description of the universal form changes. Up to this point, we've heard how the different aspects of the body of the universal form were manifest, giving the bodies of the individual, and the demigods enter, and that gives the bodies of the individual an ability to work. Then in 27 through 29, three verses, the three planetary systems, the upper, middle, and lower planetary systems based on the three modes of material nature, the heavenly planetary systems, where one in the mode of goodness attains, then the middle planetary systems, which include the earth planet. What mode of material nature do you think those on the earth planet have? Why? What are they always? They're always doing something. And this is, as Kali Yuga continues, people want to do more and more things, but without having any understanding what the purpose of activity is. Even when we sit down, we want to sit in a rocking chair so we can do something, even when we're sitting. This is the manifestation of passion, earth planet, do something. And when we do something, we gain karma or reactions for everything we do. And if the reactions are good, we will go upwards. in our next life. And if the activities and reactions are bad, mode of ignorance, we will go downward in our next life, caught and snared by the modes of material nature. So after the living entities are manifest, or are allowed to manifest and act through by the demigods entering the universal form, the next thing that happens, again, the different situations on the universal form which entail the upper, middle, and lower planetary systems. So the living entities are going to be placed according to their karma somewhere on the universal form, either in the heavenly planets, the earthly planets, or the lower planets. Prabhupada explains in the purport to 28. In 28 he explains that demigods have the super excellent quality of goodness, therefore they are situated in the heavenly planets. And then the human beings, because of their nature and the mode of passion, they live on the earth with the company of their subordinates, the animals. And Prabhupada explains in his purport to 28, the word atyantikena is very significant in this verse. By development of the mode of goodness of material nature, one can become situated in the heavenly planets. But by excessive development of the mode of passion and ignorance, when one is filled with so much desire and hankering, and I want this and I need that, then what happens is the human being indulges in killing the animals who are meant to be protected by mankind. Persons who indulge in unnecessary animal killing have excessively developed in the mode of passion and ignorance, and they have no hope of advancing to the mode of goodness. They are destined to be degraded to lower statuses of life. The planetary systems are calculated as upper and lower in terms of the classes of living beings, living entities who live there. Living entities or associates of Rudra develop in the third mode of material nature or ignorance. They are situated in the sky between the earthly planets and the heavenly planets. So that brought us to... So the living entities, after they can act, then they are situated on the universal form, either the lower, the middle, or the upper planetary systems. Now, how should they act? The human beings especially. That's going to be described in the next verses, which describe the social system known as Vanashrama, where the living entities, what's going to be described here, are the four different Varnas, or the Brahman, Kshatriya, Vaishya, or Sudras, and how they should act. And what happens right after that is the purpose of their activities are described. And after that, what is described is the purpose of the whole universal form, the whole universe. What is its purpose? And then how we know it. And then what do we do? So in 30... The varnas are manifest, and they have their position on the universal form as well. So the first one that is described is the Brahmana. The Brahmana is one who is inclined to Vedic wisdom. O chief of the Kuru dynasty, the Vedic wisdom became manifest from the mouth of the Varata, the gigantic form. Those who are inclined to this Vedic knowledge are called Brahmanas, and they are the natural teachers and spiritual masters of all the orders of society. Prabhupada explains in the purport. As confirmed in the Bhagavad Gita, the four orders of human society develop within the order of the body of the gigantic form. The bodily divisions are mouth, arms, waist, and legs. Those who are situated on the mouth are called Brahmanas. Those who are situated on the arms are called Kshatriyas. And those who are situated on the waist are called Vaishyas. And those who are situated on the legs are called Sudras. Everyone is situated in the body of the Supreme, in His gigantic Vishwarupa form. So there's the different, the living entities, and then they're placed in different planetary systems, and then they're assigned a position in the Vanashrama system, either in the head of the Lord, or the waist of the Lord, or the arms of the Lord, or the legs of the Lord. In terms of the four orders, therefore, no caste is to be considered degraded because of being situated on a particular part of the body. In our own bodies, we do not show any actual difference in our treatment towards the hands or legs. Each and every part of the body is important, although the mouth is the most important of the bodily parts. If other parts are cut off from the body, a man can continue his life. But if the mouth is cut off, one cannot live. Therefore, the most important part of the body of the Lord is called the sitting place of the Brahmanas, who are inclined to the Vedic wisdom. One who is not inclined to the Vedic wisdom, but to mundane affairs, cannot be called a Brahmana, even if he is born of a Brahmana family or father. To have a Brahmana father does not qualify one as a Brahmana. The main qualification of a Brahmana is to be inclined to the Vedic wisdom. The Vedas are situated on the mouth of the Lord, and therefore anyone who is inclined to the Vedic wisdom is certainly situated on the mouth of the Lord, and he is a Brahmana. This inclination towards Vedic wisdom is also not restricted to any particular caste or community. Anyone from any family or from any part of the world may become inclined to the Vedic wisdom, and that will qualify him as a real Brahmana. And then Prabhupada explains that this position as Brahmana is not even sufficient to be a teacher or a guru. One also has to know the Supreme Brahman or Krishna. And he quotes some verses in this regard. Kiva vipra kibena se sidra keni noi ye Krishna tatpaleta se guru hai. Showing that to be a spiritual master, that position is actually reserved only for a Vaishnava. So then, in text 31, he describes the position of the Vaishya. So what is the Brahmana's position? He is on the mouth of the universal form, and he has to be inclined to and know Vedic knowledge, and he has to speak this Vedic knowledge. That is his service to society, and that is his service to the universal form, and that means that is his service to Krishna. Then the Kshatriyas, their business is to protect the human beings and organize society in that way. So that is their service to society. That is their occupational duty. That is their service to the society, to protect the society from thieves and rogues. And that is their service to the universal form, to the whole of the body. And that is their service to Krishna. Then the Vaishyas, text 32, the Vaishyas, Krishigorakshavanijam Vaishyakama Swabhavajam, their business is to provide food and sustenance for the rest of the society. And in that way, they perform their service to society, they perform their service to the universal form, they're situated on the waist of the universal form, and that way they perform their service to Krishna. And then the Sudras, who are on the legs of the universal form, for the sake of perfecting the religious function, they're situated on the legs of the Sudras who satisfy the Lord by service. Now, all of the Varnas perform a service. They perform an activity. Service means activity. All of them perform a service to the society. So the Brahmanas guide the society through Vedic knowledge, through Vedic wisdom. The Kshatriyas protect the society and administrate the society. The Vaishyas feed it. And the Sudras serve all the other parts, because everyone needs work done. And the surjas do that. So the surjas, the mood that they have to develop is one of service. So Prabhupada explains that this is done for the satisfaction of ultimately Krishna. One can perform one's function in the four varnas for one's own satisfaction. One's function means one's service. One can do it for oneself. One can do it for the service of society. One can do it for the service of the universal form. And one can do it for the service of Krishna. But in any case, the point is that one has to develop that mood of service. Either one serves one's own body, one's family, or one serves the universal form or society, or ultimately the best is that one learns to serve Krishna. So Prabhupada explains to the end of the purport. It is actually better to be a sudra than to be a brahmana and not develop the service attitude. Because that attitude alone satisfies the Lord. Every living being, even if he be a brahmana by qualification, must take to the transcendental service of the Lord. Both Bhagavad Gita and the Srimad Bhagavatam support that this service attitude is the perfection of the living entity. It is the lack of the service attitude that keeps us in the material world, and it is the cultivation of the service attitude that will take us out of the material world. A brahmana is supposed to know this fact due to his perfection in Vedic wisdom. The other sections are supposed to follow the directions of the brahmana Vaishnava, one who is a brahmana by qualification and a Vaishnava by action. That will make the entire society perfect in regard to the order of its social construction. A disordered society cannot satisfy either the members of the society or the Lord. Even if one is not a perfect brahmana, a perfect kshatriya, even if one is not perfect, one is not a perfect vaishya or a perfect sudra, but takes to the service of the Lord, not caring for the perfection of his social position, he becomes a perfect human being simply by developing the attitude of service to the Supreme Lord. So this is the essence. The living entities are placed in this world, and this universal form is created, and the demigods enter, giving facilities for the body to work. The upper, middle, and lower planetary systems are situated to place the living entities. The four varnas with the four occupational duties are developed and situated on the universal form. What is the purpose of it all? So that the living entities who are placed within this world in some situation, that they have the opportunity to develop a service attitude. And ultimately that service attitude is perfected when it is developed towards Krishna. When one becomes a servant of Krishna, and the perfection of that is when that service is done with great loving affection. Because after all, the manifestation of one's love is the desire to serve that person, to give without getting anything in return. And one's own pleasure becomes the satisfaction and pleasure of the beloved. That is love. And that is the purpose of this Krishna manifest, the universal form, so that the universe can be created, so that the living entities can be placed, so that they can develop their service attitude, so that they can develop their love for Krishna, so that they can get out of the material world and go to Goloka Vrindavan, to give up this nasty enjoying spirit, this selfish, nasty way of thinking based on false ego, as if I am the center of everything. Text 34. All these different social divisions are born with their occupational duties and living conditions from the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Thus, for unconditional life and self-realization, one has to worship the Supreme Lord under the direction of the spiritual master. That is the conclusion. That is the conclusion. That one has to become a devotee. One has to develop his service attitude towards Krishna. Now, that ends one aspect of this chapter. Then, in text 35, Maitreya, after describing the universal form, Maitreya says to Vidura, "O Vidura, who can estimate or measure the transcendental time, work, and potency of the gigantic form manifested by the internal potency of the Supreme Personality of Godhead?" So this last part of this chapter, chapter 6, will describe something very interesting. It describes the inconceivability of the universal form. But really what's being described is that if this universal form, which is a manifestation of the Supersoul, which is a manifestation of Garbhadaksha Vishnu, which is a manifestation of Karanadaksha Vishnu, which is a manifestation of Shankarshan, which is a manifestation of Mahashankarshan, which is a manifestation of Balaram, who is an expansion of Krishna. So if that manifestation of the universal form is so inconceivably wonderful that no one can understand it, what hope by our own power do we have of understanding Krishna? So Prabhupada, in these purports, we've already heard one where Prabhupada talks about the frog philosophers and they're in the wells trying to understand what the ocean is like, puffing themselves up, thinking, oh, is it like this? Is it like this? And then pop! They're puffing themselves up, brings only their own death. So in these purports, in this chapter, Prabhupada three or four times mentions and compares those who want to understand Krishna, or even the universal form, the manifestation of the manifestation of Krishna. They're just like frogs trying to understand the ocean. Puffed up. So Ovidura, Maitreya said, who can estimate or measure the transcendental time, work, and potency of the gigantic form manifested by the internal potency of the Supreme Personality of Godhead? Prabhupada explains in the purport. The Bhagavad Gita was specifically spoken to Arjuna. And the Vishwarupa was exhibited before him at his, Arjuna's, request. He was awarded the specific eyes to see this Vishwarupa. Yet although he was able to see the Lord's innumerable hands and mouths, he was unable to see him completely. Since Arjuna was unable to estimate the length and breadth of the potency of the Lord, who else would be able to do so? We're supposed to start feeling small now. Small in our power to understand this Vishwarupa, or to speak of, to understand Krishna playing his flute in Brajadham. One may only indulge in miscalculation like the frog philosopher. The frog philosopher wanted to estimate the length and breadth of the Pacific Ocean by his experience of a well 3 cubic feet large. And thus he began to puff himself up to become as big as the Pacific Ocean. But at last he burst and died by this process. This story is applicable to the mental philosophers who, under the illusion of the Lord's external energy, indulge in estimating the length and breadth of the Supreme Lord. The best path is to become a cool-headed, submissive devotee of the Lord, and try to hear about the Lord from the bona fide spiritual master, and thus serve the Lord in transcendental loving service as suggested in the previous verse. So after understanding that the whole purpose of the universal form is to provide facilities for the souls to develop their serving mood ultimately to Krishna, therefore to understand Krishna, one can understand that He's so, so, so great, and therefore one should develop a submissive attitude in regard to Him, because He is so great and we are so tiny, and hear about Him. Text 36. Now here is Maitreya speaking. In spite of my inability, because he said that this universal form is inconceivable and impossible to describe, but yet he's just described it. He's described it and then said, actually, it's impossible to know and describe, actually. Who can estimate or measure? He's described it. So therefore, he says, in spite of my inability, whatever I have been able to hear from the spiritual master, and whatever, who did he hear from? Krishna himself, actually. With Uddhav, just before Krishna left this planet. And whatever I could assimilate, whatever I heard and whatever I can assimilate, I am now describing in glorification of the Lord by pure speech, for otherwise my power of speaking would remain unchaste. This is very important. That we may not be able to understand Krishna. In fact, not only may we not be able to understand Krishna, we cannot understand Krishna. But here's the puzzle. If we can't understand, how can we speak about something that we can't understand? But Maitreya is doing it, and he's telling us that unless he engaged in speaking what he has heard and assimilated according to his own realization, small as the percentage may be of what he is saying of the totality of truth about Krishna, yet it is not incorrect because it is what he's heard from the cyclic succession, and therefore he has to speak this. Why? Otherwise, the tongue, which must speak, one cannot stop the tongue from speaking. Otherwise, if one doesn't speak about Krishna, the tongue, which must speak, would remain unchaste and would remain contaminated, and it would entangle one in sinful activities. Prabhupada explains in the purport. The purification of the conditioned soul necessitates purification of his consciousness. By the presence of consciousness, the presence of the transcendental soul is verified. And as soon as consciousness leaves the body, the material body is not active. Consciousness is perceived, therefore, by activities. The theory put forward by empiric philosophers that consciousness can remain in an inactive state is the proof of their poor fund of knowledge, their foolishness. One should not become unchaste by stopping the activities of pure consciousness. If the activities of pure consciousness are stopped, certainly the conscious living force will be otherwise engaged, because unless engaged, the consciousness has no standing. In other words, there is no question of the consciousness being inactive. Even when we sleep, we dream and move. What to speak of when we're awake? There's no question, not even for one moment, can the consciousness be inactive. So therefore, the consciousness has to come out in a pure way. Otherwise, because it has to be active, it will come out in an impure way. When the body does not act, the consciousness acts in the forms of dreams. Unconsciousness is artificial. By induced extraneous help, it remains for a limited period. But when the intoxication of the drug is finished, or when one is awake, the consciousness again acts earnestly. Maitreya's statement is that in order to avoid unchaste consciousness activities, he was trying to describe the unlimited glories of the Lord, although he did not have the ability to describe them perfectly. This glorification of the Lord is not a product of research, but the result of hearing submissively from the authority of the spiritual master. It is also not possible to repeat all that one has heard from his spiritual master, but one can narrate as far as possible by one's honest endeavor. It does not matter whether the Lord's glories are fully explained or not. One must attempt to engage one's bodily, mental, and verbal activities in the transcendental glorification of the Lord. Otherwise, such activities will remain unchaste and impure, and they will entangle us in the material world. The existence of the conditioned soul can be purified only by the method of engaging mind and speech in the service of the Lord. The Tridandi sannyasis of the Vaishnava school accepts three rods representing the vow to engage in the service of the Lord with body, mind, and speech, whereas the Ekadandi sannyasis, the Mayavadi sannyasi, takes the vow to become one with the Lord, one with the Supreme. Since the Lord is the Absolute, there is no distinction between Him and His glories. The glories of the Lord, as chanted by the Vaishnava sannyasi, are as substantial as the Lord Himself. And thus, while glorifying the Lord, the devotee becomes one with Him in transcendental interest, although he remains eternally a transcendental servitor. This simultaneous one and different position of the devotee makes him eternally purified, and thus his life becomes completely a complete success. Maitreya continues. The highest perfectional gain of humanity is to engage in discussions and activities and glories of the pious actor of Krishna. Such activities are so nicely arranged in writing by the greatly learned sages that the actual purpose of the ear is served just by being near them. Oh, my son, talking to me. The original poet Brahma, after mature meditation for 1,000 celestial years, could know only that the glories of the Supreme Soul are inconceivable. Prabhupada mentions about the froggish philosophers in this purport too, saying that they can't understand. These philosophers, like the frog and the whale who tried to estimate the measurement of the Pacific Ocean, like to take trouble over fruitless mental speculation instead of taking instructions from devotees. So one can't know Krishna through the process of speculation, through one's own powers of intelligence, no matter how intelligent one is. We should not be like the froggish philosophers. Rather, we should hear, we should read, study what Srila Prabhupada explains, what the great acharyas explain, what Maitreya Muni explains about Krishna in disciplic succession. The wonderful potency of the Supreme Personality of Godhead is bewildering even to the jugglers. That potential power, I was thinking when reading this, that a person who, just imagine someone picking up this book for the first time and he reads, the wonderful potency of the Supreme Personality of Godhead is bewildering even to the jugglers. He must be thinking, what? How, bewildering even to the jugglers? But Prabhupada explains in the purport what he means. So we'll read that after. That potential power is unknown even to the self-sufficient Lord. So it is certainly unknown to others that the Lord doesn't even know his own potency. As soon as he knows it, that knowing increases and changes things. So therefore it's changed again. So he has to know it again. Because if you know something, knowing that you know it, being conscious of something changes it. And then if it's changed, it's more than what it was. So Prabhupada explains. So no one can know Krishna fully. So we have to give up the speculative attempt to know him and learn about him through hearing about him. That's the point. And that will, with a service mood, which is the purpose of the whole thing. So Prabhupada explains, the froggish philosophers and mundane wranglers in science and mathematical calculation may not believe in the inconceivable potency of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, but they are sometimes puzzled by the wonderful jugglery of man and nature. Such jugglers and magicians of the mundane world are actually puzzled by the jugglery of the Lord in his transcendental activities. But they try to adjust their bewilderment by saying that it is all mythology. How could a boy who's only 6 or 7 years old lift up a hill with the little finger of his left hand? How could he expand himself and dance with so many gopis in the middle of the night? How could he have 16,108 palaces for his 16,108 queens? It must be mythology. But why can't Krishna do this? Who can say that you cannot do this, God? If God wants to do it, who will stop him? So they have to say it is mythology. There is, however, nothing impossible or mythological in the Supreme Omnipotent Person. The most wonderful puzzle for the mundane wranglers is that while they remain calculating the length and breadth of the unlimited potency of the Supreme Person, his faithful devotees are set free from the bondage of material engagement simply by appreciating the wonderful jugglery of the Supreme in the practical field. What is the practical field? This world that we see. The devotees of the Lord see the wonderful dexterity in everything with which they come in contact, in all circumstances of eating, sleeping, working, etc. A small banyan fruit contains thousands of small seeds, and each seed holds the potency of another tree, which again holds the potency of many millions of such fruits as causes and effects. So the trees and seeds engage the devotees in meditation about the activities of the Lord, while the mundane wranglers waste time in dry speculation and mental concoction, which are fruitless in both this life and the next. In spite of their pride and speculation, they can never appreciate the simple potential activities of the banyan tree. Such speculators are poor souls destined to remain in matter perpetually. And the final verse in this chapter. So after describing the universal form and how wonderful it is, and how the devotees, they will just hear about Krishna and think about him. They don't try to fully understand him because they understand that he cannot even understand himself fully. What to speak of them, tiny, insignificant us, understanding him fully. So they don't try to do that, but rather they faithfully hear about Krishna and chant his glories as far as they have assimilated them. And the final words. Words, mind, and ego, with their respective controlling demigods, have failed to achieve success in knowing the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Therefore, we simply have to offer our respectful obeisances unto him as a matter of sanity. So Maitreya has fulfilled the request of the Dura, who said, explain to me about the energies of the Lord, but please explain everything in relationship with Krishna. Prabhupada's purport. The froggish calculator. So there's jugglers, wranglers, and froggish calculators. May raise the objection that if the Absolute is unknowable, even by the controlling deities of speech, mind, and ego, namely the Vedas, Brahma, and Rudra, and all the demigods headed by Brihaspati, then why should the devotees be so interested in this unknown object? If he's unknowable, why be interested in him? The answer is that the transcendental ecstasy enjoyed by the devotees in delineating the pastimes of the Lord is certainly unknown to non-devotees and mental speculators. Unless one relishes transcendental joy, naturally one will come back from his speculations and concocted conclusions because he will see them as neither factual nor enjoyable. So one has to simply offer his obeisances to Krishna and become a servant of Krishna, become a devotee and hear about Krishna, be happy hearing about Krishna, glorifying Him according to our own capacity. And in this way, keep purified even in this contaminated material world. And see Krishna everywhere in the material world. Yomam pasyati savacha savam chaimari pasyati. See Krishna everywhere. Marvel at Him. In every seed. In every buzz of the sora in the backyard. Everything. We should think about Krishna. And always be Krishna conscious and be happy. Okay, thank you very much. Any questions or comments? Okay, we'll stop. So